I called it ethical treatment of all Christian symbols, and want to say first of all what I mean by that, and then go almost immediately into discussion after I've explained what those words are trying to get at. And I'll just, since many of you are at the Bible study this morning, I'll just make an observation about that as a way into the subject. When Paul asked near the end of the session, does Scripture have application for today, meaning the reference to the discussion to that point, there was an immediate reply, yes, and you should note, the discussion turned immediately to moral and ethical issues. The first one that was mentioned was abortion. And then it moved on to other discussions about the taking, other dimensions of the taking of life. I just make that observation because it is so typical of what is happening in Christian theology and ethics today, and I mean in local congregations, I don't mean in seminaries. That is, biblical and theological study and reflection goes almost immediately to issues of morality and ethics. So that's part of what I'm getting at. Now, that may not strike you as unusual or new, but I want to say that that has not always been so. Obviously, morality and ethics have been vital to Jewish and Christian faith, but not quite so insistently and consistently as today. For example, the great church councils that gave us the great creeds, the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed, or that hammered away at some of the great doctrines, like the doctrine of the Trinity, pursued theological reflection, pursued thinking about Christian faith in ways that didn't move immediately and insistently into matters of ethics. You talked about how is it that Jesus Christ is both divine and human. That's not a moral issue. And theological reflection didn't move into it as a moral issue. Or how is it, I'm just illustrating from other periods of history, how is it that the three persons of the Godhead, God, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, relate to one another? What is the Trinity about? That's not an ethical discussion, it's a metaphysical one. And a lot of theological reflection and a lot of discussion about Christian symbols, the divinity of Christ, the membership of the Godhead and relationship of the Godhead, have had to do with that kind of discussion, the formulation of doctrinal beliefs that weren't immediately moral and ethical in their implications or at their center. Because the task of Christian faith then was to work out its relationship to the world of classical culture, and that kind of thought world of that world was preoccupied with those metaphysical rather than moral issues. Or let me give another example of times when it hasn't been the case that you've had the ethical treatment or insistence on the moral and ethical dimensions of Christian symbols, and I'm going to argue that ours is a time when we do have that. Luther's Reformation. Luther's great theme was justification of the ungodly by grace through faith. And I would argue, and many would argue, that in some ways it's profoundly related to Christian ethics and the Christian moral life. But the focus there was on the graciousness of God to set the relationship with creation right, wholly apart from moral performance. That's one way you tag good works. Good works aren't part of what it takes for salvation. Salvation is initiated by God's side toward the ungodly, and the ungodly are saved by grace. Neither good works nor evil ones have anything to do whatsoever with one's salvation. That's Luther's contention. There's another example when thinking about Christian faith and then relating all of the Christian symbols, cross, redemption, salvation, was done in such a way where it wasn't focused on or qualified by moral and ethical considerations. So those are just two examples, the great creeds and some of the early doctrines, and then the Reformation theme, where the attention isn't to morality and ethics. And now I want to say that today, the central place of moral issues is also, or is right at the heart of understandings of Christian faith itself. And at this point, I want to already turn this into a discussion of sorts and have us brainstorm a bit and ask why it's so. Now, you may want to also give some examples if it's not clear that it's so, or if you don't see evidence that it's so. But let's do that in the course of saying why it is that now you don't talk about matters of Christian faith without almost immediately getting into moral ethical issues. What gives rise to this? Who's got some notions? Yeah.
Just the thought that immediately comes to mind here, our recent historical experience of events like the Holocaust, like the nuclear arms race, and so on, give moral and ethical issues a life and death quality.
Yeah.
You have to.
I think that's exactly it. So many of the great issues that we face are moral and ethical issues. And as you say, some of them at least have a life and death quality. There's an enormous amount at stake in our world. And the great issues are moral issues. And the church has always been in that kind of position where it sometimes willingly and sometimes begrudgingly responds to the world around it, but it can never ignore it and doesn't ignore it. In our time, I think you put your finger right on it, the main reason why we're getting now a moral and ethical treatment of all Christian symbols is because the great issues of the time are moral issues, the use of power. You mentioned shaking events like the Holocaust or ominous developments like weapons of mass destruction. But there are many others, issues of wealth and poverty, issues of hunger. Those are moral issues. A whole set of issues around the taking of life. In the Bible study, abortion was brought up in that context. It quickly moved in the Bible study to questions of war in Scripture. You and I know I have had to face those questions of maintaining life support systems for people who are critically and terminally ill. So the euthanasia question, questions of biotechnology and the ability to intervene and manipulate the very building blocks of life, all the discussion around DNA and genetic engineering and genetic intervention and creating new life forms. Those are all moral issues. They're questions that put before us the question, what ought we here to do? Impact on the environment, human rights, use of resources, the moral health of society, and other issues of character. Time magazine has introduced a new section in Time magazine. You know what the title of it is? Ethics. Never had a section on ethics before. Everybody's talking ethics now, partly because of insider trading on Wall Street, worrying about the character of kids and the role of public education for moral education. Just all around us, it's moral issues.
I think in addition to the pardon,
I was just saying hospitals are employing ethicists.
Yes.
In Spokane.
Yeah. And they're setting up ethics committees. National Institutes of Health has commissions to oversee the use of human subjects and also animal subjects in research. There are ethics committees being set up. Even corporations are hiring ethicists. And law schools, medical schools are introducing courses in ethics. Well, just going on and on the same, very same point, that the moral issues are the ones that are all around us. And that's the reason.
There's another part of it, I think, where that not only are we currently attracted to the moral issues.
Yeah.
But speaking broadly, I think that speculative thinking has pretty well gone out of style. Anyone who's lived in Europe and seen the ravages of, say, the 30 Years' War, you know, you still see the cannonballs lodged in some of the places there. And the newcomer, scholarly historians aside, the casual tourist, the one passing by, what in the world were they fighting about?
Mm-hmm.
What was all this about? And whenever you check these things out, you find terrible battles that were waged over an idea.
Mm-hmm.
Or at that time, they considered a principle.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you'd have to go through busloads and busloads of tourists to find one who could tell you what that idea was, what they were fighting about. And I think that in the 60s, the young people, maybe not altogether altruistically, but because their meat was on the hook and they were about to be shipped off to somebody else's war, as they saw it, they invented a phrase which I will not use here, but heard frequently at the time, anything that involved any kind of speculation was what's called mind dancing. And they just didn't want any more to do with it.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to me that as a people, we are now at the, it'll change, sure, you've been up in the flow, but I think, of course, now we're at the so what stage. All right, Prof, so what?
Yeah.
You've been off thinking what are the thoughts. Let me know when you get back. And when you get back, I've got a question for you. So what?
Uh-huh.
And the so what is,
what are the
what are the ethical implications?
What are the consequences?
Yeah. Help me out with this. So, in the meantime, I'm going to watch the Bears and the Vikings.
Yeah.
This is the communication advancement itself one of the factors. Inner dialogue and challenge.
Because we become much more aware of.
We have more exchange of ideas and questions and challenges.
And I think so, but I'd like to hear a little bit more of what you're getting at. How would that bring us to focus on moral dimensions? Because we're more aware of different possibilities, or our own are more challenged?
We're more in contact with the secular world, and I know mm-hmm. this morning they touched on the challenges of the secular world,
mm-hmm.
and the blending of hierarchical lines, and the different, various denominations didn't used to communicate like this
mm-hmm.
now.
Yes, that's true. It's a smaller world. Yeah, more contact. Yep. Bill, and then Randy.
And there's been a lot of attention on the part of theologians, preachers, and writers to those parts of the scripture that are specifically concerned with the ethical and moral questions and development of liberation theology, feminist theology, and speaking to where people are today.
I want to pick that up and say a couple things about it. But let me get a couple of these others up here. small world, concern for consequences, more contact and communication.
Question.
Yeah.
Is your question, why is it that theologians and philosophers are paying more attention to this, or
no,
people in general? Because
yeah,
it seems to me that in general, people are probably, have always been more focused on moral and ethical questions than maybe philosophers and theologians have. Or let me put that in the form of a question.
Yeah,
philosophers and theologians kind of wander off into the abstract, but the events of recent times are so demanding,
yeah,
that it's forced them back to issues which it seems to me that the more average person is more likely to be dealing with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Good point. That may well be the case. That sort of primary concern about what do we do now is a concern that hits more ordinary folk all the time, and that what we call theology has been somebody else's enterprise. Yeah.
Pierre. On the same point, that I'm just thinking that the conversation is a lot larger now than it ever was, and so ordinary people are setting the agenda,
yeah,
more than they ever were.
Yeah.
Or participating. That,
yeah, and I want to connect with that immediately, because the comments that I made yesterday and the day before, that different groups of people are now have their voices in theology and ethics that didn't have their voices there before. And those groups are pushing this because that's exactly where they've been. Black theology, women's theology, Native Americans, the poor of Latin America, you mentioned liberation theology. Their experience pushes this. Look at the moral and ethical content and consequences of these symbols. We know, we've experienced some of those consequences, and you've used those big words. Now we want to know what those big words mean. What is our moral content? Yeah, because we have, and so these groups have pushed this agenda. Yeah, John.
I also see that before the Second World War, there was a status quo. The world was orderly. I mean, Britannia ruled the waves, and we could in this country be isolationist. And that whole status quo has been disturbed. So what you're looking for now is also vision.
Uh-huh.
What are we going to do with it? We need a prophet.
Yeah.
So we get a more a vision idea. What do we do with war and peace?
It was easy to laugh at the concept of apocalypse, too, at one earlier times. And now we don't know whether we want to laugh at that or not.
Yeah, when I went to seminary, I couldn't even spell apocalypse. And it just wasn't a word in anybody's vocabulary. Now they make movies with it in the title. You know?
But you see, there's underlying all of this is the thought that maybe we're not going to make it.
Yeah.
And that comes with the young people.
Yes.
Just strikingly, because they become the outworkings of what we repress. And all of a sudden, you're starting to see this teenage suicide thing take off, and you're starting to find the basis of it in the same. They're just working out what the adults are trying to set aside for a while.
Yeah.
So looking, maybe there is a need for adolescent theology that might give us a little bit of insight to what's going on.
They're already doing it, and we're maybe trying to catch up.
We're still trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Perhaps this is tied in with several of these other remarks, mm-hmm. but it seems to me that one of the developments, or the development that has brought the ethical question into practically everyone's life at some point or another is the technology which has made possibilities available that weren't available even 30 years ago.
Yep.
So for instance, if you take the question of euthanasia,
uh-huh.
that question has been around for as long as humankind has dealt with the question of inevitable death,
mm-hmm.
that now that question is given greater latitude when one must decide how we are going to use the technology which can postpone the inevitable into an indefinite future. So that, so whereas grandma might have died a natural death inside of 2 weeks if she had a stroke 25 years ago, now the question is, should we keep grandma alive indefinitely in a semi comatose state? And those are questions that practically everyone has to deal with.
I'm gonna give it a general topic here and just call it the multiplication of choices. Ethics arises only with possibilities. If people have no choice, then you have no moral decision to make. As soon as you expand choices, you have the gap between what is and what might be. And we, the modern world, one of the characteristics of it is an enormous multiplication of choices in all arenas, and you put your finger on some of the more, one of the more agonizing ones around the termination of life. It relates directly to discussions earlier about increased power in human hands. With increased power in human hands, you have increased possibilities to do what may not have been doable before. And I don't think this has really sunk in to us, because for a very long time, the primary function of religion and even of Christian faith was to help people deal with what they couldn't change. The world was a kind of given. The world was a place where things happened to them, but over which they had really very little control. There was much suffering. There was often much joy because good things happened, but their part in the goodness, the coming of the seasons, rain time and harvest, maybe famine, but they had relatively little control. You can plant the seeds, you can water, etc. Disease, famine, to look at the darker side, had relatively little control over that. And so much of theology and so much of Christian faith and so much of religion was to somehow address a world with relatively little choice and to make some sense, especially of suffering. Now we're in a situation where faith has to turn to the question of what do you do with the multiplication of choice and enhanced possibilities and the ability to change what previously could not be altered. Yeah, Randy, you had your hand up. I apologize. I lost.
On the last one, I think not only multiplication of choice, but the communication thing matters in here, and because we all know what those choices are, and a choice that's made halfway around the world.
Mm-hmm.
100 years ago, we would never have heard about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we did not know that there was an issue there. Now we all know about it and hear about it, and so our choices are multiplied, but our understanding is all multiplied.
Yeah.
The other comment, I think theology has also, your comment, it's really with the development of the social sciences, we move much more in cooperation with social sciences and less, I think, with philosophy. And there's a real difference between philosophical thinking and social scientific thinking.
Yeah.
And I think that relates to some of the third worlds. I mean, they're not dealing with philosophical abstractions.
Yes.
They're dealing with social scientific data.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of theology is doing that, taking much more account.
Very, very important point. When our thinking about Christian faith finds its partners or its aids from other fields in order to formulate it, what those other fields are about helps determines a lot. And if it's philosophy, then it makes theology be given to speculation. When it's the social sciences, theology turns to what? The transformation of society. Or when it's psychology, the turn is to what is does faith mean for the dynamics between people and in my own psyche. Well, that change, if you move to the object of Christian faith is to somehow grapple as a Christian with the transformation of society, then you've moved into ethics. Yeah, the partners here. Yeah.
I don't know whether you equate control with choice, but it seems to me that there have been earlier periods in our history in the United States where we've had a much stronger sense of control than we have today. I mean, yeah. Certainly when we were younger, the 50s or the 40s,
yeah.
There was a sense
we had more power, really.
Of not only in the world, but in our own society, a confidence or an optimism mm-hmm. about our ability to manipulate science for the better of the world, social confidence about our political and social. So it seems to me that there are completely contrary trends to this concept of greater choice that are going on, that are more pessimistic.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a good point. I think the world seems out of control now.
So is that the opposite of choice? I mean, in some cases we've got choices over very limited realms, but we have this sense, I mean, the fact that we know this person around the world is doing something doesn't give us control over that person or a sense of being able to control it.
Maybe we're just now seeing what the results from those various controls and choices. Maybe they're being defined for us.
Go ahead. I'm listening. I'm just not able to keep up with everybody.
All those choices make me feel chaotic. There are times when I'm in a grocery store and I know there's 4,000 items in there for me to choose. It drives me crazy. I kind of wish I could stand in one.
Don't understand.
Yeah. But I think that both that phenomenon, which we all experience, and the multiplication of choice happen at the same time. That's why I don't think choice and control are synonyms. We have more choices to make, but that doesn't necessarily end up being a more coherent, much less universe, much less one over which we have any more control. But the choices are what makes the moral ethical factor here. Yeah.
I think control and choice are joined because those in control made our choices and we were apt to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the recent times mm-hmm. we were apt not to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this has made a big issue of ethics and morals.
That's right. When the standard lines that you depended upon for expressing your own moral, I mean, you did it by delegation. You voted or something, and then you trusted those representatives to act morally on your behalf. When that breaks down, and you see evidence of distrust, then it comes back to you somehow, as well. Yeah.
In terms of history, are you able to point to other periods where there was a comparable turning to moral and ethical issues in the history of Christian sort of, when would that be? What kinds of things were occurring in other periods where a similar focus occurred?
Yeah. Sometimes it's...
What happened after the Black Death? I mean, that was sort of catastrophic.
Yeah. I'm not a historian who can tell you what happened following that. I can tell you that one of the rediscoveries in biblical studies and in early church studies, third century, is a rediscovery that Christianity is early on conceived of as a way of life. and that it has a moral and ethical profile to it, which is in contrast with its own wider world. It thinks of itself as living a life of faith that is simultaneously a way of life. That's ethics as a way of life. So the third century baptism, for example, was a ceremony where after you had been instructed in the way, incidentally the Christians were first called, before they were called Christians, were called people of the way. And it means a way of life. And it has moral and ethical profile. So people of the way were instructed in the way prior to baptism. Then they make it a decision. Are they going to join this group and its way or not? And you turned toward the West and you renounced the devil and all his works and all his ways. But that had very specific meaning in the Roman Empire. It was associated with violence, for example. You renounced violence. You renounced bread and circuses. You renounced the way of the Caesar. That's why you turn west, toward Rome. Then you turn toward the east, toward Jerusalem, and then you stated positively, I believe in. But there isn't in early Christianity a distinction between theology and ethics. They're both bound together as the way. And it's a pluralistic world, many possibilities. I don't know of, there may well be, but there are very few other times where the world is so pluralist and so diverse as it was in the first century in the Greco-Roman world. All religiously, ethnically, all sorts of folks there. So people chose the way. Philosophy, incidentally, at that time was the philosophical schools advertised ways of life. And you were converted to philosophy. Can you believe that? If you chose this philosophy, it was because you chose a way of life. Christianity was early on regarded as a school of philosophy. And you didn't think, the term was practicing philosophy. You practiced it. That is, you lived this kind of thing. So that's one time. I can think of some other times. The radical wing of the Reformation, the left wing of the Reformation, saw itself as over against the imperial Reformation, Luther and Calvin, in terms of a style of life. And what were the big issues? Church and state, that is the use of the power of the sword, and Christian pacifism. Wealth, that is the sharing of resources. They're all marriage and it's the bond there. Those are ethical issues, and the left wing of the Reformation saw itself dividing on those lines over against other possibilities. But I still think that there is something in our situation which even intensifies that. Randy?
Your last comment, I would suggest that one of the other reasons is a return to the kind of early Christianity or
a re-understanding
of biblical material. That's trying to recapture that sense of not a disjunction between
that. And I we're not going to have time to. If I had more time, I would take you through some of the things that Paul also gets at and does so much more competently than I. But if you take both the formation of Israel and the formation of the early church, you have the same thing going on. Namely, the Sinai experience, after the people are delivered from Egypt, and they're in the wilderness, what is the task? The task is the formation of community. How do they go about that task? They ask, what now, as a people of God, do we embody in our own life that reflects the character of the God who liberated us? And they answer that question by saying things like, God have visited us as aliens and sojourners in a foreign land, therefore we must show hospitality to the stranger. Or God liberated us as slaves, therefore we shall not hold Hebrews as slaves. God did this, and it's all an effort, and it shows up in their politics, it shows up in their economics, it even shows up in their health care and other things like that. We find the Pentateuch and those chapters in Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy just extremely boring, all of that law. But it's an effort to give social and moral embodiment as a community to the experience of God. There is simply no separation of morality and theology there. It's an inferential ethic from the experience of God. What happens at Pentecost? Go back and look at Acts. After there's this experience of the visitation of the Spirit, what are the questions that people ask? What are we going to do now with our houses? Now that we've gotten religion, what are we going to do with our land? Do we keep it? Do we sell it? Do we give it away? Do we share it? I mean, they immediately turn to the practical questions of the formation of community. How do we break bread together with people that are in our fellowship but are way off there in Jerusalem? Paul asked that question to the Corinthian church. They're poor and we're not so poor. Yeah, koinonia. The word where this building is called koinonia, and you know that's a word for fellowship. It's also the name of the offering that was taken, because that's how you share. But in both the birth of the church and in the formation of Israel, you have this immediate connection of everyday moral issues, things that folks face, and what that has to do with ethics. And most of them look to Jesus as a pattern, as an example, in order to answer the question, just as Israelites look to their experience of God. It's an imitation of Christ's ethic, as it was for the Hebrews, an imitation of God ethic. Yeah. I want to say one more thing, and then we'll just keep the discussion going. The one point we just made is that in biblical studies, what has been shown is that the distinction itself between theology and ethics makes no sense. The two are just inseparable from one another. And that revival in biblical studies has made a difference, too. One more comment. Here about I've said the ethical treatment of basic Christian symbols. There is also in theology and ethics now what, for lack of a better term, might call the moral or ethical qualification or testing of basic Christian symbols. And by that I mean such as this. I mentioned that many voices which have been marginal voices are now prominent voices. And those same people tend to push us toward a moral qualification of all of our talk of God. For example, take anti-Semitism. There's a long and deep and regrettably murderous history of anti-Semitism in Christendom. Jews have been called Christ killers. The church is seen as the new Israel that displaces the old Israel. And Israel has been interpreted as a rejected people of God, although the Christianity is not a rejected people of God. Now, people who have been sensitive to that long, deep, and deeply embedded anti-Semitism in Christianity have been pushing. Well, first they've seen how deeply Christian words and symbols have participated in that. I think of Rosemary Ruther's book, Faith and Fratricide, which is a treatment all the way from some late New Testament documents all the way to the present and the anti-Semitism in Christianity. And what do they do? They then, being sensitized to deep and important moral issue, issue themselves a kind of qualification for any later God talk or any later thinking about Christian faith, and say things like, if a way of talking about Jesus fosters anti-Semitism, then we must reject that way of talking about Jesus. That's an ethical or moral test for every Christian symbol and for all of our talking. If a way of talking about what it is to be church nurtures, fosters, plays into anti-Semitism, Jews are a rejected people, the church has replaced Israel as the new Israel, then that way of talking about church is not credible. No matter who's been saying it, no matter how long they've been saying it, it's not credible. Or if the interpretation of Scripture is done in a way that oppresses women, then that interpretation is rejected as morally and theologically credible and binding. That's what I mean by a test. Or if faith is taught in such a way that serves the welfare of some, say the powerful, but not others, say the powerless, then the way that faith is taught and its formulation is rejected as theologically valid. So you've got a moral and ethical test for all God talk and our talk of Christian faith.
Larry, and, who sets these agendas?
Well, I'm saying that...
that's a rhetorical question. I'm not challenging. I'm just wondering.
It's coming from many, many quarters. And many of the quarters are people who have not had a strong voice.
Okay, how do you test those?
Yeah.
You see, because there can be any a voice and another voice converging,
right.
And we can say, well, this one came here and this one came here and it converged, therefore we're going to use that as the agenda.
Yeah.
Now, I'm just asking you, what criteria do you use then to pick and choose these particular things?
Well, let me, I don't know if it's a direct answer, Gary, let me respond by describing what's happening. And that is all sorts of dialogue, that is different people talking to one another about
that. Yeah, I
don't
object to this, you understand. I'm just curious about how this is all going to flow from the top.
Yeah.
I think the test would be love. The Christian love of, and God's love for all people. No matter what, and if the whatever under discussion didn't reflect that, then it would have to be rejected. If it were,
is that what you mean by testing? I'm not sure what we're talking about.
Maybe there is another criteria by which we test those agendas, by which we then turn around and say we need to reevaluate our doctrinal stands or creedal stands or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't reject any of those that have been presented, but then I'm wondering.
It raises the question. Sure, of course, of course. Yeah.
What I see happening all the time is if I hear someone expressing their hurt, the women hurt, homosexuals hurt. When I hear this hurt coming all the time, then I examine myself and say, what is it I do? Maybe what is it we do as a community that causes them to hurt? And maybe we're not guilty sometimes.
Yeah. My response was I think, too facile in just saying dialogue, listening, hearing one another out. That doesn't yet set criteria for when is this a valid agenda and or a valid contention. But it is the kind of starting point, and you're talking about that communication, about that listening, etc., about being open to hearing. Now, Tom.
Remember back when we were, which is very young, the first time we really had anybody talk to us about ethics, two things they said. One was, can't shout fire, got to be eater. The other thing they say is, You can swing your arm, you can swing your fist until it stops in somebody's nose. And then you gotta stop. Mm-hmm. And it's happened to me, I imagine it's happened to a lot of folks here, after church, after liturgy, something, and I think it's just been beautiful. When somebody comes to me and tells me that Faith of Our Fathers song has really, I suffer through it every time I hear it. Can't you do something else? And then maybe we argue, maybe we don't, but I can never again do that Faith of Our Fathers song with the same virility and the same zest, because it's going to hurt Marjorie. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, I think not just individuals, but constituencies say, please, this is hurting me. It never occurred to me until 20 years ago that the way we talked about Jews and read about it in the scripture was in any way could relate in any way to what happened in the Holocaust. But now I'd like to rephrase things, because I can see some connections now that I didn't see before. Mm-hmm. But somebody said, you hit me in the nose.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can expect to hear a whole lot more people saying, you hit me in the nose. And we're going to have to narrow our...
The criteriology is interesting how it unfolds here, and I hear two things. I hear love and justice as major criteria. If someone says, I'm being hurt by what you're doing, that certainly is a violation of our obligation to embody mercy and compassion and love. And then there are others that saying that I don't have equal access to power, my rights are being violated. That seems to be a very powerful criterion. It's a matter of their rights being violated. It's an issue of justice. And I guess this community, through its biblical and subsequent tradition, has been trained that it must not hurt and it must not violate the rights of any individual. And the women, for example, when they say that that offices are closed to them and levels of power are not open to them, that immediately then is translated into an issue of justice, as are these others. We're very vulnerable to those claims because of the
faith. The faith itself, makes us vulnerable. But
the voice came from above. Is that the final word now?
No.
That was Paul.
One of them. That was Paul. And I don't know if you saw the blackboard before I erased it, Paul, but your picture was up there and it said St. Paul Hansen on it. Oh. Don't confuse St. Paul with God, though.
Just across over there.
Just one quick comment. If you make love and justice the criteria, you've made ethical criteria the criteria.
We ended up playing very nicely into your
region. Thank you very much.
There still remains a need, though, to do some defining of what constitutes law.
Our justice, right, and goodness.
We got to push that a bit further.
Yeah.
I think that's where much of the discussion is these days.
What is
justice? How do we define that?
Can't you
define it through the old biblical idea of shalom? If you only go back to as a guide,
certainly not undefinable, but it's not immediately self-evident.
That's right.
What love is.
Sure.
It's somewhat existential, too.
Yeah.
It's not a.
I don't want to close things down here, at least not for about 5 more minutes. But I thought, hearing that point, I thought it would be kind of helpful, interesting, and maybe even fun to now take a key Christian symbol and just ask what some of the moral and ethical dimensions of that symbol are. Since this is what is being pushed, and since, as we've just been talking here now, we kind of measure results by ethical criteria themselves, like love and justice. When I grew up, I don't recall that there was any particular moral and ethical dimensions that were taught to me, say in catechism or elsewhere, in Christian education, and which I did not receive from worship, for the Eucharist, for the Lord's Supper, for the sharing of bread and wine. That was a rich symbol. It meant a lot, and in some ways it, I think, went deep. But I just don't have dimensions of that that I would say are moral and ethical and that orient the rest of my life or become part of a way of life. And now I hear people talking in theology and ethics about the Eucharist as rich in moral and ethical content. But how does it strike you? Or pick another one if you wish. Well, baptism is another one.
Take the 1 Corinthians 11 and the approach to the Eucharist was an examination, a moral examination. Uh-huh. It was not within...
That's true.
It wasn't just one isolated event that you couldn't, that you'd kind of come to, but nothing went before, nothing went after. It had to be contained within someone taking a real hard look at what was...
Moral examination of yourself.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
That's a good point.
In fact, there was quite a warning, and maybe some indication that there was some judgment there.
Yeah.
If you did not go through that process.
Yeah.
So I see it as a very strongly, at least a very strong tie-in.
Yeah. And later on it became institutionalized in such things as confession and penance, etc., and worthiness to receive. Yeah, that's true, and I hadn't made that connection.
I don't know the extent to which others can identify with this, but being a Catholic, in my growing up days, the whole emphasis, we used to call it the sacrifice of the Mass.
Yeah.
And the sacrifice was Christ's dying. And that was just all throughout. And then we'd have communion. But the sacrifice of the Mass, and it's just so entire, just
turned around.
And now it's the Eucharist. I don't hear my talk about the sacrifice of the Mass. The Eucharist.
Yeah.
And people come together. We used to look out corner of our eye and see we're walking up for communion. Now let's see, could they... Wait a minute, it's 11 o'clock. Have they fasted since midnight last night? And all that kind of nonsense. It's a day of none of that. The emphasis is on the coming together, on the sharing of Christ, and, just a one man's lifetime. What a spin of the wheel. Has it been something like that within your tradition?
Probably not quite so much as a Roman Catholic. I mean, I think of Roman Catholic theologians now writing about that. I think of, for example, the lovely little book by Monica Hellwig, The Eucharist and the Hungers of the World, interpreting hunger in many dimensions, material hunger, that is physical hunger, kind of what we might call spiritual hunger, etc., and Eucharist as food and the sharing of food. Relating to various kinds of hunger. Well, it's then rich then with moral and ethical dimensions. Or another Catholic theologian, it's a French fellow, Martelet, Gustave Martelet, who talks about the risen Christ and the Eucharist. But anyway, he in the passage in there where he deals with the Eucharist is one where he says that if we participate in this sign of the abundance of God and shared God's life shared with us in bread and wine, then it is blasphemous not to share the bread and wine that we have with others. I mean, there's an immediate sort of connection. That's one example. Those are Catholics who are relating to that central symbol. They would go on to say that it's not meaningless to talk about sacrifice anymore, but these are other dimensions which weren't there when we did focus entirely on the sacrificial death. The cross is another one. Cross now means sacrifice. It also means representing a new order, the way of life that represents a new order, God's reign or God's kingdom, in an unwilling world. And this, you can expect something like cross when you represent that order in an unwilling world. So cross is very much tied to way of life. And that has more ethical content, as well as the sacrificial death.
Paul said that if we partake of the bread and receive not the body, we bring in damnation.
Yeah, that was.
And if you participate in the death of Christ, in communion with Him, and you participate and recognize your own unworthiness, if you experience that, then you receive that humility that allows you to deal with these ethical questions.
Yeah.
That you're not superior to these people and you can't sit in judgment.
That's a good point. And I find that in the literature now being developed for Christian education, there is increasing attention to what we might call moral formation. That is the shaping of our characters. What are what are our attitudes? What are the virtues? Humility, courage, forbearance, strength, etc. These things that belong to who we are as persons. And there is more attention to looking at basic Christian symbols and what that might mean for the formation of our character. What is nurtured in the kinds of people that we are? Kindness, forbearance, etc. Those are all character traits.
I can't help, Larry, but pick up a strand you already mentioned, too, that this contextualizing our symbols and sacraments within an ethical, social domain is also reinforced by our accepting more clearly our indebtedness to Judaism.
Yeah.
And also to Hebrew Bible religion. I'm thinking of the Seder as being located in the family, recalling the Egyptian with the drops of wine sprinkled on the napkin. I think of the entrance Torah. This came to my mind when someone mentioned 1 Corinthians 13, who shall ascend to the hill of God and who shall stand in God's holy place? The one who has clean hands and a pure heart and does not lift up the soul to what is false, does not swear deceitfully, that one will receive blessing from the Lord. Etc. And of course the famous, with what shall I come before the Lord, in redefining sacrifice, you know what God wants, what God requires, doing justice, loving kindness, walking humbly with your God.
Yeah.
And then finally, after the destruction of the temple, normative Judaism, the Pharisees, redefined sacrifice as the act of loving kindness.
Mm-hmm.
And that isn't to say that they eliminated the sacramental, but they so tied the sacramental to the ethical that what you described happened, they became indivisible.
Mm-hmm. Good. That's helpful and interesting. Well, so some of this is a rediscovery of biblical faith. Some of it is brought on by the great issues of our time and all sorts of reasons that we've given here. And I find it encouraging, helpful that we do have this kind of ethical treatment of Christian symbols, because it's not moralizing as such. We've had far too much of that. It's a genuine kind of concern for what basic symbols of faith have to do and say about truly enormous realities that all of us face. Thank you.